Well, of course, if you've seen the Mad Max movies, check in with us and tell us what you think the future will be like. Share your views with us. And we'll be back in a moment with Terry Hayes as we talk about his work, I Am Pilgrim, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Terry Hayes with us. Terry, if somebody did let go some weaponized smallpox, do you think it would be a nation or some rogue group?
A rogue group. I have no doubt of that. Any nation that was responsible for that would find themselves wiped off the face of the earth very fast. I mean, look, North Korea is obviously, you know, a state run by complete lunatics.
He's insane. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. And but you know, he's not so insane as to try to use a weaponized form of smallpox, because if nothing else, his neighbor China would wipe him off the face of the earth, let alone what America would do. So I think it's a rogue group, and I think it's so easy to introduce something like that into America, because you don't have to have suicide infectees, which is the general thing that, America ran a thing called Dark Winter, which was a war game basically around the introduction of smallpox into America. And they abandoned Dark Winter after a very short time because they realized you didn't need to game it anymore, because the results were so devastating. But they used suicide infectees. Now, there was a group in history called the Hittites. They were the last person to use suicide infectees with a disease, and that was God knows how many thousands of years ago. Because America has exported so many of its jobs and so much of its manufacturing base, there are any number of items that are coming in to America that are not monitored in any meaningful way whatsoever. One of the largest suppliers of medical drugs to America is China. And I think of the 500 factories, it is in the book, I might get the numbers slightly wrong, but I think of according to a congressional report, the 500 factories that provide medicines to America, I think only 13 were inspected.
There's no quality control. Look at the fiasco with the jerky treats for pets coming out of China.
Yeah. And we got upset about pets, and, you know, my family are all pet lovers, and, you know, we're mad dog people, but I tell you what, if we can't control the health of the pets, we sure haven't got much hope with the population at large.
No, we don't. So how do you see it unfolding, Terry?
Well, we can't stop it. You mentioned this earlier. I mean, you can police your borders. Yes, you can try to use Echelon or any number of other NSA programs to sweep up all this data. You can try to monitor what's going on in the world. Every intelligence agency in the world will tell you the thing they fear most is a clean skin. That's the guy I use in the book, a guy with no entry in any database in the world. He's never gone on any, you know, online forum and ranted and raved about the great Satan America. He's never, you know, gone to a local mosque and stood up and made a big noise. It's always the quietest person in the room that's the most dangerous. And that's the guy that I use. He's kept himself completely out of attention whilst he's educated himself and developed this. Look, everybody will tell you, CIA, MI6 in England, anybody will tell you, that's the guy you fear most. You wouldn't even know where to start finding him. And so if you look at what is going to happen, you're going to get somebody like this, or a small group of people probably related to each other, because then you get a loyalty. I mean, don't ever forget, you know, Jesus had 12 disciples. One of them betrayed him. So, you know, it doesn't take much for people to get so agitated within these groups that they will betray each other.
Well, and now we know that, now we're hearing stories that Judas might have been in on it, right?
Yeah. So, you know, how do we stop this. I mean, yes, if you've got a larger group of people, you might get one of them to betray it. If they're a family, that's a much more tough thing. If they're working as a solo operative, virtually impossible. So I think it's going to be a rogue person or a rogue group very closely bonded together.
I mean, I could picture Jesus saying to the group, somebody's got to betray me. The script says someone has to betray me. I need a volunteer. Nobody would do it. So he just pointed over to Judas and said, you're it.
You're the guy, because this is what is needed. And, you know, I mean, it's one of the great, you know, I mean, the most interesting things I think about Christianity, and that is that we wouldn't have that story, that great epic story, which has informed so much of Western civilization, without Judas. So, in a way, he fulfilled an incredibly important function.
What great pathos, throwing the money back, hanging himself. It had it all, didn't it?
I tell you, it is the greatest story ever told. It is, because it's got everything. And, so you're always going to get with it. Look, you know, Jesus in that period, he was a revolutionary. He challenged the established order of things. Well, somebody betrayed him. And, you know, if that happens with that small group of people, it's pretty obvious it's going to happen with any other group of, you know, bomb throwers, whoever they are, unless they're family or unless they're a clean skin. And that's where I think the danger comes. There's only one thing on the shelf in the biological weapon department that can wreak enormous damage, and that's smallpox. And we made a very, very large mistake, a huge mistake, and that is that when it was supposedly eradicated.
That was 79, I think, right?
Yeah. And, okay, what happened then was all the research stopped. It coincided a short time later with the rise of AIDS. And so all the money, all the glory, all the Nobel Prizes started to go into AIDS research. And, you know, because smallpox there was no threat. But, of course, you know, it says in the book, and I think it's a pretty good saying, that the world doesn't change in front of your eyes. It changes behind your back. And we're now in this brave new world of bioengineering, with no research having been done on finding a cure for smallpox. If you can find a cure for smallpox, you take the greatest biological weapon straight off the shelf. There's nobody, a clean skin, a family, or a tribal group who are going to try to weaponize smallpox if there's a cure. But seeing as we have no cure, it is the most frightening of all the weapons and the most likely to be used.
Okay, it sure is. Let's go to some calls here for you, Terry. Let's go to John in Sarasota. That's in New York, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program, John. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. Good morning, George, and good morning, Terry. And I do love your accent very much, and that is Saratoga, New York, the horse racing capital.
I wanted
to talk about 9/11 and how we find out all these people were Saudi, and we don't wind up attacking Saudi. We wind up attacking another nation, even though that they are all over the place, and it comes down to big money and oil again, as always. I think that we should have probably had free oil for several years on something like that. And also the biological area, I kind of see something happening like a Stephen King book where we're working on all these bugs and things like that, and one does escape. And, you know, these level 4 containment centers, you know, are bound to screw up one time or another. And I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, John. And Saratoga Springs, that was mentioned in the Carly Simon song, You're So Vain, I think. That's my knowledge of it. it's weird, isn't it, that the Bin Laden family, as we all know, was spirited out of America. And I still don't quite understand why that happened. But as you say, this is, the, you know, the Saudi royal family, supported by America, and you know, that's energy policy at play. And you know, it's almost, you know, insoluble until America becomes energy independent. You know, and then maybe you know, America or Australia's foreign policy will change. As far as superbugs escaping, yes, you know, we've had the case of anthrax being, you know, sent deliberately through the mail, and there's a lot of research going on into any number of bugs. But an accident's one thing, John, you know, and human beings screw up all the time, and that's tragic. But I don't think an accident it's certainly not as frightening to me as somebody who comes up with using the American healthcare system to introduce smallpox. And that is the fundamental plot of the book. And how do you use the American healthcare system? Because, you know, we were mentioning before that America has become so reliant on drugs that are manufactured overseas with virtually no quality control. So whilst I think there are many, many dangers, and of course there is always the ever-present threat of something escaping, a greater threat, I think, is people that wish the Western world, you know, destruction. And that, so, yeah, we got a lot to worry about, and I guess I'm more worried about, you know, people who are going to do it deliberately.
And that's a huge concern.
Yeah. It you know, accidents, yeah, you know, look, you know, that's a terrible thing. But yeah, look, we saw 9/11. We've seen countless examples of this around the world. You know, I mean, you know, there's a bombings at Karachi Airport yesterday. What, 28 people dead?
Yeah, horrible. Yeah, people are all whacked out. Look at the shooting we had in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Two police officers sitting down having a little pizza, and then they go into a Walmart and kill someone before they commit suicide, basically. The wife kills the husband because the police were getting too close to him, and then she kills herself. People are whacked out, Terry. They're just strange.
Well, yeah, and I think that it's not just America. I mean, we see, you know, you see a guy get on a plane in England with a bomb in his shoes, and
yeah.
You know, I mean, just by the grace of God and some good fortune and some alert passengers, it doesn't end in disaster. There's no end to the crazy things that people do, and it makes the world a very frightening place.
Back to the calls we go. Let's go to Robert in Joplin, Missouri. Robert, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing, Robert.
Sir, I love your films. Nothing but great respect for you. Mad Max was one of my favorite movies. There's been dozens of copies. There's a technical question I had for you. On Mad Max's car that he had, it had a supercharger or a blower on it.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone that knows anything about mechanics knows that a supercharger has to run constantly for it to work. And on the movie, he would flip a switch and get it to work when he needed more power to go really fast. And I wondered why you did that, put that into the film.
And it's a great question. And you know, there is a highly technical answer to this. And that is this: we screwed up.
That's an honest answer.
Well, it's an honest answer. And it's been pointed out to me a number of times over the years. And, you know, all I can plead in defense is that when you're making a movie, you've got 5 million things that you're trying to keep an eye on. And sometimes you have to rely on, in this case, the art department and your stunt department. And you know, I think George felt that, you know, it would be a good idea, you know, when we're doing the sound mix, to get the roar of that engine and to really, you know, show that the car was really powering on. You know, it kicked it up a level. Nobody pointed out to us at the time, I can promise you this, nobody pointed out to us at the time that this was a mechanical, impossibility, that it wouldn't work like that. So you're absolutely right. You are correct. And yeah. We were wrong, and we have to live with it. And I saw the movie for the first time up in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. I saw it on the big screen for the first time, I think, in 28 years. And, you know, I think, without being too self-serving, I think the movie holds up. But I have to tell you, that's not the only mistake we made. And I have to live with every one of them. But you're absolutely right. You're very observant, and you know more about cars than I do. So that's me. I've admitted to it. But thanks for the call.
Terry, the quest was always to get some gasoline, to get fuel for their cars. Who produced that fuel that was, you know, in some of those little fuel depots that they stumbled across?
Well, you know, within the film, obviously, that the survivors did. We were out there. I mean, you know, we were so far from big cities and that. And one of our problems out there was actually getting fuel for all of our vehicles that we were using in the film. So this was a perfect case of art imitating life. And,
yeah.
you know, it was because you run through a lot of gas when you've got all those big V8s roaring along. And you know, they had so much equipment on the cars. You know how it says your mileage may vary, you know.
Did anybody
vary? It was really low.
Did anybody ever get hurt during the filming?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
what happened?
A person called Guy Norris, who went on to become the stunt director of some very, very famous movies. He was sort of like our lead stuntman. And there's a scene in the movie where a vehicle goes under the big tanker that Mel's driving. A vehicle goes under and sort of gets sort of half crushed, but manages to come out the side. And then a little dune buggy rolls and a bike comes along and hits the dune buggy, and the rider somersaults off it at high speed. That rider was Guy Norris, and we did it, and, you know, you put a lot of boxes down, a lot of mattresses, some air foam, you know, filled mattresses and that, and you do that for a large area, and, you know, you hope that he's going to hit it, you know, on this everything that you have prepared, and he did. The only problem was that when the bike hit the dune buggy, it wasn't the frame that was there to protect his leg that hit the dune buggy. It was much higher up, and it was his thigh that hit it.
Oh, ouch.
And that was the end of that leg. Yeah, busted his leg in a very, very bad way.
God.
It's an awful, awful feeling when you're standing there and, you know, what is something that, you know, you try to be so safe about, and there's somebody who, for all you know, as you run towards it, may well be dead.
Excruciating pain. Terry, we're going to come back with final calls in a moment. On our next Coast to Coast program, for the first couple hours, split show, we're going to talk about the secret history of the EPA. It'll shock you. And then later on, the amazing story of unmanned space exploration. And when we come back in a moment with Terry Hayes, we'll take final phone calls as we talk about his work, I Am Pilgrim, dealing with the weaponization of viruses. Back in a moment. Welcome back. Author is with us, Terry Hayes. Terry, how much money did Mel Gibson make on his first Mad Max? What do you think?
I'm not trying to avoid the question. I really can't remember. I'd be surprised if it was more than $10,000 or $20,000.
Oh, wow!
I know that when I wrote the script for Road Warrior, I was earning. I was quite young. I was earning $75,000 a year working in the media, and that was a lot of money. That was
a lot of
money back then.
Sure was.
Yeah, when you were when you were young and unmarried and had no kids, it was especially a lot of money. And I worked with George. George said to me, do you want to work on this script? And I said, yeah. And we started working. We worked for a while. And finally, I said to him, hey, George, am I going to get paid for this? He said, sure you are. Sure, of course. I said, how much? He said, well, $12,500. And I thought, it didn't take me long to work out my lifestyle was going to take a fair change. And I said, he said, well, is that okay? And I said, well, yeah, I guess, you know, because this is a huge opportunity. And that I said, when do you think I'll get some of this money? And he said, well, you only get it if the film's made. If the film's not made, you don't get anything.
So a spec script, right?
Yeah, it was a spec script, but for nothing. But anyway, to do George justice, he did renegotiate the deal when the film started to work, and then I became, you know, a business partner with George and that. So extrapolating, and I genuinely don't remember. I'm not trying to be, you know, evasive here, but extrapolating from my experience, I don't think Mel got much either.
What? I bet he laughs today thinking of what he made on that first movie. But, you know, you got to start somewhere.
Oh, and you know that there's this great saying that, you know, fortune smiles on the prepared mind. You've got to be prepared for it, but you've also got to have the courage to grab it. And, you know, as the years went by and, you know, I ended up being in a very fortunate position of being able to, you know, make movies in Hollywood where, you know, you do get very well paid. I would always look back and say, yeah, but when I started, I was willing to do it for nothing. So it gave me some sort of sense that whatever unfolded in my life, you know, it wasn't just, you know, sheer blind luck. I had taken some really, you know, big risks.
Sure did. That was 1981, The Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Long time ago.
Well, unfortunately, but, you know, luckily I look as young now as I did then.
Good for you.
I wish, George.
You're Benjamin Button. To the phones we go. We go to Mike in Minneapolis to get us going here. Michael, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Terry. Great show.
Thank you, Mike.
I'd like to say that I'm not as afraid of smallpox as I am the vaccines. I think that... you know, we've got a government problem going on right now where our government sees us as like lab rats, and they're doing all kinds of experiments on us and stuff. I don't know if that's what's going on in Australia, but here in America, we're just lab rats. And, you know, I'd like to ask you a question, Terry. Do you think that God... knows about lasers and waves and rays and beams?
I'm not an authority on this. I can't say that I've researched any of this. But I'm always willing to learn. But you said earlier that you know, your government sees you as lab rats, and you know, you're not sure if that's what's going on in Australia. One of the things that I can say in reference to being here in America and coming so often and comparing it to Australia, and that is that it always strikes me when I come to America of how intrusive your government is into the lives of you know, ordinary people. And I think because it appears to me, to an outsider, and I may be wrong, but a much more intrusive thing into people's lives, I think that Americans, given their nature, tend to become vastly more suspicious of their government. If I can draw a comparison to Australia, our government in Australia is nowhere near as intrusive. You know, we have very little to do with what our government does, you know. And so I think that we tend not to be quite as suspicious of the government. And that's just one of the things I've noticed every time I come back to America. It's something my wife and I, you know, her being American, we discuss a lot. And I just don't know why that has occurred in America. And I'm not sure that it's something that, that you know, that is a healthy thing. As far as the other part of your question, I really would just be, you know, would be guessing about that and talking off the top of my head, and I try not to do that.
Terry, are you still writing films and scripts?
Yeah, I had lunch with my agent and lawyer today here in Los Angeles, and they paid, so I guess that's a good
sign.
Excellent.
Who's your agency out there?
William Morris Endeavor.
Good people.
Good people. The head of the motion picture division is my agent, and good people. I've been tied up writing the novel. I've got another novel that I'm writing at the moment, but, you know, I think in due course that those novels will be turned into films, and of course I will write the screenplays for those. But, you know, I think Michael Crichton had a very great career, you know, Jurassic Park as a novel and then as a script, and I sort of modeled it partly on that.
You seem like you have fun doing this, Terry.
I've had fun talking to you tonight, that's for sure, and you play great music. Can I tell you that? You play great music. I could just sit and listen to you and the music all night. I it's been blessed, George. It has been a really blessed life, and I'm fully appreciative of that. I mean, I get to do something that I'd always wanted to do as a kid. I've had, you know, some success at it. I've been able to provide, you know, for my family. And hey, if I'm not having fun at it, I mean,
it's not
would
worth
I be the most ungrateful person in the world?
It's not worth it. And you know what? And I got to tell you, I have fun doing this show every night that I do it, Terry. I mean, where can you go where years ago you watch a movie called The Road Warrior, Mad Max, you love it, and then all of a sudden you end up talking to the guy who wrote it? I mean, you can't beat that.
Yeah, you know, I think working in the media and look, it shows through that you enjoy your work. I mean, I've done, you know, a lot of media here in America, and of course I did a lot for the movies and that, and you can always tell the people who are engaged, who are curious, who are going out there and using the media to inform themselves and a much wider group of people, comes through loud and clear on your show. And, you know, it's why you're successful. There's no two ways about that. And I think that people respond, whether it's in a movie house or reading a book or listening to the radio, they respond to people who are really enjoying their work and are really engaged with their work. We've all seen movies that have been made by people who did it for the paycheck.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And our callers, our listeners, as you are finding out, Terry, are the best I have ever heard anywhere. They're informed. They go out and search out for information, and they love to question, you know, guests, and they have a great time doing it.
And it shows through in all the subject matter that you cover. I mean, who would have thought that some guy from Australia gets on your program in America, and there's some guy living in the heartland who knows the mistake we made on Road Warrior?
That's a good point. Let's go to David in Rye, New York, east of the Rockies. David, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Terry. It's an honor to talk with you guys. Just curious, it pertains to some stuff in your novels. If you've ever heard of Plum Island off Long Island, where they supposedly, through government experiments, created Lyme disease accidentally. And I just want to say, Terry, your work is great. I just read a novel that made me think of your movies. It's called Plague of Angels, The Descendant. You should make it into a movie. You should check that one out. But thank you, guys. I appreciate the call.
All right. Oh, you're welcome. Go ahead, Terry.
Thank you so much. I haven't read Plague of Angels, but I'm scribbling it down now, and always happy to read other people's work. And, of course, I was looking for things to turn into movies. I hadn't heard of the first thing that you mentioned, but I'm certainly going to have a look at that. I mean, you know, once you get interested in this whole field, it becomes a bit like Topsy, you know, it just grows and grows and grows. And this is the great thing about the callers. I mean, you hear stuff that you never normally would come. across. So that's fantastic, and thank you so much for sharing that.
Next up, we go to Shirley in Monticello, Iowa. Hey, Shirley, thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk to both you masters of your arts. I am inquisitive because I saw the Road Warrior, and Mel Gibson and Tina Turner were just the greatest actresses and actors I'd ever seen in my life. I got a question, Mr. Hastings, about the pigs that were in there making energy. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, this was in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and that was the third one in the series, and Tina was fabulous to work with, total rock and roll royalty. It was great, a lot of time you sit around on the set, it's so boring, and there's not a huge amount to talk about, but of course you could always say to Tina, well, what's Mick Jagger really like? And stuff like this. So it was pretty neat. It was George Miller's idea that we used, pigs pooping to turn into energy. That's where the world's going. So he was ahead of his time, that's for sure. We thought it was a unique sort of twist on a world that had run out of, conventional fossil fuels. We didn't anticipate how difficult it would be to work with all of these pigs, who are actually very intelligent animals, but not quite as intelligent as they needed be. And we made a rod for our own back. But I think it worked in the movie, but I, for one, have never made a movie with pigs again.
Who came up with the line, two men enter, one man leaves?
Oh, I have to own up to that. That's
a great line. I love that line.
Yeah, thank you very much. I came up with the line Road Warrior, and I hear it all the time. People traveling all the time. Well, he's a road warrior. Two men enter, one man leaves. and there's a few other lines that, you want to get out of here, you talk to me. From Road Warrior, Mel says that. So, yeah, it's always neat when, I'm a pure victim of pop culture, and I really enjoy popular culture. And if you can make a bit of a contribution, however small, that's something that it's a neat thing to do.
Let's go to Pompano Beach, Florida. AJ's with us now. AJ, you're on with Terry Hayes on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, AJ.
Hey, Jerry. George, I've been a long-time listener. I really appreciate you having him on tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting me get through. I had a little problems with my phone earlier, kept disconnecting. I had a couple questions for you. Two quick ones. One, I know you said that you were in New York about 20 years ago. Did you get any grief about, first of all, did you get any grief about people maybe coming at you, giving you the old Crocodile Dundee treatment with your accent? I know it wasn't too close to when the movie came out, maybe a little bit after it, but I know you might have got some little bit of attention there.
Funnily enough, I was in America around when the movie came out, and I thought every time I opened my mouth, somebody would say to me, "A knife? You call that a knife?"
Yeah, I know. I bet you're just walking around waiting to say that.
Yeah, and of course, the first few times you hear it, it's funny. The 50th to the 100th time, you're sort of starting to lose your sense of humor.
Yeah. And also, when you were talking earlier about how with the Muslims, about how they how it's got to be a political solution, I've been in the Middle East. I've been all over the world. One thing I've noticed is one of the main things that's keeping the Muslims with such a death grip on their religion being in their politics is that it puts such a clamp down on the women in their society. And most people, like in this, I know people say that Americans don't really live a sheltered life, but honestly, most people don't even realize that the Muslims, the Jewish people, and the Christians all worship the same God.
Heck, that's most right. Muslims won't even admit that. And, you know, it's, you know, to be able to somehow come up with a political solution, they're going to have to come up with a social solution first, I feel.
I mean, look, that you know, that is really the responsibility, in my view, the responsibility of those countries, of those cultures. And if they wish to organize their society in that way, well, that's up to them. If women in those countries feel that they wish to have a different relationship to menfolk or to their government, well, you know, I for my money, I sort of feel that that's their fight. But you know, the Western world is always running around trying to save people, and you know. You know, the suffragette movement, you know, for women, you know, moving towards the vote in Western countries, that was fought by women in those countries. And you know, I admire them enormously, of course. But it was their job. Nobody came and, you know, tried to help out there. Of course, you know, it all becomes complicated because there's, you know, oil involved. So it's a very complex problem, but it's not going to be solved, I fear, by us telling other people what they should do.
The name of the book, I Am Pilgrim. Terry's website is linked up for you right there at coasttocoastam.com. Mr. Hayes, thanks. I'll look you up when I get back to Los Angeles, okay?
Yeah, please do, George. It's been such great fun. Terrific listeners, wonderful questions, and you know, it takes a lot to keep me up to 2 a.m. in the morning of where I am, and it's been worth every moment of it. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, my friend. Get some sleep. For Dan Galante, Will Wilkerson, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safer.